Because of his love of cars and mechanical gadgets, some thought him progressive, while others, in the majority, frowned on his unorthodox tastes as those of a child intrigued by toys. A much more serious charge, we were told, was that the young regent was not honest. More than once Chinese gold lured him into serving the interests of China. 7 years after his appointment, the regent had a dream in which he was advised to abdicate his post or lose his life. Whereupon he immediately became a meditating monk in Sera, one of Lhasa's big monasteries. Then Tokra stepped in and took over the regency. It was not long before China, feeling the loss of its Tibetan puppet, instigated a revolt in Lhasa aimed at the overthrow of Tokra and the reinstatement of the Reting Rinpoche. The monks of Sera were involved in this fracas. There was considerable fighting in the holy city, redrobed monks versus the government forces. The insurrection was put down, single-handed by Sakang Suwon Kempo, the 32-year-old son of the present foreign minister. Sakang went to Sera Monastery, put the Reting Rinpoche under arrest and, without interference from the monks, carried him off to the Potala. When the Rinpoche left the Potala shortly afterward, it was for his burial. No one in Lhasa seems to know how he met his death behind the towering walls of the Dalai Lama's winter residence. We had that story in mind as we sat before the regent, sipping tea and chatting politely about our visit to Lhasa. In view of the fact that Buddhism was introduced into Tibet from India, doesn't your highness think it would be a good idea for Tibet to send Buddhist missionaries to other countries? Dad asked the regent through our interpreter. A very good idea, the regent agreed, and smiled gently. As we were about to leave, his highness called us to his divan and presented each of us with a white scarf and a small red one, like the one his holiness had already given us. Kayapup told us it was a special compliment to receive these red scarves from the regent and the Dalai Lama. Now we were off for a real photographic spree. We were in high spirits. The audience with the Dalai Lama was in itself a concession rarely made to outsiders. But we were given an even more unusual opportunity, permission to take pictures, both still and movie, of the young incarnation of the Buddha of Mercy. According to our guide and interpreter, many long-established precedents were broken to grant us this privilege. Never before, they said, had motion pictures been taken of the Dalai Lama, never had any been taken in color. Why were the bars lowered for us? Again, because of the communist peril and Tibet's desire to win friends in the West. We hurried to Lhundup Jayatsal, a gem of a pagoda with roof of gold in the center of a flowered pond in the summer palace grounds. There His Holiness awaited us. In full outdoor sunlight, a slightly elevated throne was surrounded by shrubs and flowers. Having checked our light meter and determined camera angles, we gave the word that we were all set. Out strolled the Dalai Lama to ascend his throne. The regent, the Lord Chamberlain and a group of royal secretaries lined up on either side of the young Dalai Lama. Royal gowns were properly adjusted by attendants. Then we began shooting from all angles with our four cameras. 30 minutes later we had finished. His Holiness had performed marvelously. He smiled when asked and agreeably changed position for our cameras. With these outdoor pictures, we thought the show was over, but it was suggested that a few pictures should be taken of the Dalai Lama on the throne, before which we had been blessed earlier in the morning. This was almost too good to be true. Although the throne room was very dark for Kodachrome, we did manage to get His Holiness to stand in a shaft of sunlight by one of the tapestried pillars, where we filmed him talking to his staff, and I took several flashbulb shots of him perched on his throne, wearing the yellow peaked cap which is his crown. We were much impressed by the young ruler. He seemed human, kind and gentlemanly, and by no means a terrified puppet. We did not speak to him directly, nor did he say anything to us except for a soft lols, yes, accompanied by the Tibetan sucking in noise of politeness when interpreter Kayapup told him our wishes regarding camera positions. After introductions were made, we took the whole family to the roof of their home to photograph them in color. Most striking of this group were the Dalai Lama's mother, Tekite Zairing, and his plump 32-year-old married sister, Tsiringdama. Both wore multicolored silk robes and Tibetan fur hats and had jewel-studded charm boxes hung around their necks. These charm boxes, Cao usually set with turquoise and other precious stones, are standard jewelry equipment for most wealthy women in Tibet. They are not merely for decorative purposes. A talisman is frequently placed inside the charm box to bring good luck to its wearer. And if the Cao is set with stones of good quality, it is believed to strengthen one's bones. Now Dor led us down to the courtyard to take some close-ups of the actors and to make a recording on our battery-driven portable tape recorder of the weird music and chanting fantastic and strange to our Western ears. When I walked out on the stage with the recorder over my shoulder, the tiny mic held in my outstretched hand, the play practically came to a halt. The actors forgot themselves and stood gaping at the strange instrument, while the audience howled with laughter. A new wrinkle had been added to one of their ancient dramas, and they seemed to like it. Some even thought the filming and recording were meant to be part of the act. Unwittingly, I made quite a hit as a Tibetan actor. The next time these folks see that play, Dad said later, they'll suspect the management of cheating them when you don't make an appearance in the third act. We were much impressed in Lhasa by the expansive and overwhelming hospitality of the Tibetans. During our 11 days in the capital, our hosts kept us on a continual merry-go-round of interviews, parties and sightseeing. Once you know them and have their confidence, they open their homes and their hearts and can't seem to do enough for you. With the help of our Lhasa hosts, we accomplished in less than 2 weeks what would have taken months in most Oriental cities. We shall always hold warm, pleasant memories of the friendly, generous-hearted Tibetans we met. Parties, reinforced with plenty of food and chang, barley beer, are the chief recreation of the people who live in the second highest capital on Earth. La Paz, Bolivia, is several hundred feet higher, since they have no automobiles, no theaters, no radios, no organized sports, no newspapers or magazines, and practically no books except ancient scriptures which only a few can read. These gala gatherings, often prolonged for 3 days, are the most popular source of amusement and relaxation. In the summer season, they love picnics, often putting up beautifully decorated tents and pavilions in the parks and open spaces around Lhasa, and feasting in the open for days on end. Every night we returned with heads spinning and stomachs overstuffed to our quarters at Traitalinga. Since we only attended affairs given by high nobles in their homes or official government receptions and functions, the behavior was restrained enough to satisfy Emily Post. However, similar gatherings throughout the country are often raucous. The object of every host and hostess is to ply their guests with as much liquor as possible. The party is considered a complete success only when the guests are in a state of complete stupor, showing that the wine was irresistibly good. If a guest is so intoxicated that he cannot rise from his chair, a ceremonial scarf may be placed round his neck as a compliment. Most of our contacts in Tibet were with nobles and high lamas, or government officials drawn from both these groups. This was natural, both because we had been invited by the government and because of the short time we had at our disposal. Most of all, we wanted to see Lhasa, and Lhasa is the official seat of the secular government, and of the religious administration. The nobles, sharing important administrative positions with the monks, have great power. They own nearly 2/3 of the land, the remainder belongs to the monasteries. In their country places they live much as did the baronial lords of medieval Europe in great luxury, but minus plumbing and other conveniences we in the West accept as necessities. The nobles maintain in their households several tailors and craftsmen, perhaps an artist to paint thangkas, or religious scrolls, and an army of other servants to handle the arduous tasks which have to be done manually when no mechanical gadgets are available. So many domestic necessities, food and clothing, even the leather and rawhide from the yak are produced on the estate, that most noble households are practically self-contained. Usually, too, the noble has his own private monk, who lives in the house, performs all the ceremonies of the religious calendar and is on hand to take care of the special prayers when any of the family is ill or sets out on a journey or needs to call on the help of the gods for some special undertaking. In Tibet, the nobility are almost a race apart. A wide chasm yawns between them and farmers, herdsmen and other humble commoners. The peasant bows low before the landlord or official and uses a different and meekly respectful vocabulary in addressing the noble class. The peasants on landed estates are bound to the soil much as were European peasants in feudal times. They make their rental payments in labor, crops and cash. The houses of the nobility, built of stone around a central courtyard, are impressive. Storehouses for grain and food and stables for horses, mules and cattle occupy three sides. The family residence, opposite the wooden entrance gate, closes in the fourth side and, rising above the other buildings, is, sometimes 5 stories in height. But few of these semixels have glass windows, an imported product, for the cost is prohibitive. Only in Lhasa do the rich indulge in glass as a special luxury. In the country homes of the nobles as well as in the Lhasa homes we visited, the finest and largest room is always the chapel or shrine room. Here are kept all the art treasures, mostly religious. Of course, rare images of the Buddha and the deities favored in Lamaistic worship, some of them studded with jewels and draped with rosaries of glowing amber, newthankas, shining in strong, brilliant colors, and precious old ones from which the colors have faded, copies of the Kaniyur, the Tibetan Bible, and of the Teniyur, or commentaries, rare Chinese porcelains, ornate Tibetan silver teapots. The Tibetan host usually receives a formal guest in his chapel. But every Tibetan has some kind of shrine room, even if it is only a few feet square, as we learned when we spent the nights along the road in village homes and peeked into the tiny compartments, where butter oil lamps were kept burning before images of the Buddha and favorite Buddhist saints. The poorest peasant dedicates a corner of his tiny hut as a shrine. The peasant women, as well as the men, are a rugged, hardy lot. The women, as has always been the case in the rural hinterlands of Europe, do the housework, look after the livestock, carry fuel and work in the fields beside the men. After my father's accident on the journey out of Tibet, his teams of bearers sometimes included 2 or 3 women. They were just as strong as the men, and withstood the rough trip without complaint. Along the trail on the way to Lhasa we passed many peasant women, square as set and well muscled. They were not beautiful, but they had strong, determined expressions, and looked as if they could dominate any situation or argument with their menfolk. In Tibet, unlike most Asiatic countries, women have had equal rights with men ever since the early days of Buddhism. Rockhill says that the preeminent position of women in Tibetan society has been from ancient times one of the peculiarities of the nation. This may surprise many Americans who have an idea that our progressive country was the first to promote equal standing of both sexes. Actually, some of our states are still in the dark ages as far as progressive legislation for women is concerned. Here's where remote Tibet is ahead of us. When a Tibetan boy and girl marry, they do so on equal terms. Then and there an agreement is made as to what it will cost either party to get a divorce, should circumstance make separation desirable. If they do part, the one on whom the blame falls has to pay. The woman takes charge of the household and does the domestic tasks unless her husband has servants, in that case the wife supervises them. But the man does his share of domestic work, too. He often cooks the elaborate feasts for holidays like the New Year, and he does much of the family sewing, especially on leather garments. If a woman's husband is away or dead, she manages the estate until the oldest son comes of age. And with her menfolk she joins in all merrymaking and fun as well as in all responsibilities. The only reservation which must be made is that few Tibetan girls can choose their own husbands. Their parents arranged the marriage, but sometimes a determined Tibetan girl in love finds a way of getting around this difficulty, even to an elopement, as girls do elsewhere. And one recalls that in enlightened modern France parents still choose the husbands for their daughters, partly for practical reasons and partly on the ground that they are better qualified to make a wise selection. Polygamy is practiced only by those who both desire it and can afford to support more than one wife. Many men in Lhasa and elsewhere in Tibet have only one wife. However, polyandry is common among nomad herdsmen and peasant farmers. When a girl marries one of these commoners, she is automatically wed to all his younger brothers as well. The latter may avail themselves of all husbandly privileges until they decide to get married and start a household of their own. All the children of such a union are the legal offspring of the woman's number one spouse. But in a land where nearly 1/5 of the males become priests pledged for the most part to a life of celibacy, it does seem unreasonable for one girl to be permitted to have more than one husband. One would hardly expect to find a moral code similar to ours in such an entirely different Jandina feudal, Buddhist society. It was no shock to learn that Tibetans practice polygamy, but we were, though, rather surprised that polyandry, usually found in a primitive state of society, prevails in Tibet, which in so many ways has a high level of culture and civilization. W. Rockhill, of whom I have spoken in another place, offers an interesting explanation of the practice. In the land of the Lamas, he says, the tillable lands are of small extent and are all under cultivation, so it is extremely difficult for anyone to add to his fields, which as a general rule produce only enough to support one small family. If at the death of the head of the family the property was divided among the sons, there would not be enough to supply the wants of all of them if each had a wife and family. Moreover, the paternal abode would not accommodate all of them. The secular experience of the whole human race showing that several families cannot live in peace and concord under the same roof, the only solution of the problem in this case was for the sons of a family to take one wife among them, but which means their ancestral estate remained undivided, and they also saved considerable money. In contrast to the peasant women, many of the aristocratic wives and daughters of officials whom I met in Lhasa are beautiful, with light, clear skins and sparkling eyes. The women of the nobility do everything possible to keep their complexions light and smooth. During the winter they stay indoors as much as they can to avoid the fierce winds that toughen and darken the leathery faces of peasants and nomads. In summer they either carry parasols to shield their faces from the sun, or attach visors to their hats. Cosmetics, both Oriental and Occidental varieties, are in great demand. Some women smear caoutchouc on their faces to prevent toothache and discomfort occasioned by the bitter winds, and also because they believe it will protect the skin. The gala costumes of both the peasant and the upper-class woman are much alike. Exquisitely made of rare silks and studded with gold and jewels, these magnificent dresses are priceless. Every peasant woman of moderate means has at least one such dress reserved for special occasions. Every noble woman owns many. The Dalai Lama's mother, for example, has one magnificent outfit in her wardrobe which could not be duplicated in America for $25,000. The most striking ornament of the whole ensemble is the headdress. The wooden framework, over which the long hair is draped, is heavily ornamented with turquoise, corals and seed pearls. Those who can afford it wear the characteristic long earrings of gold, set with turquoise, pearls and coral, and two or three strings of prayer beads around the neck, of coral, lapis lazuli or amber. Neck clasps, buttons, and bracelets of gold or silver and the charm box set with turquoise or more valuable gems comprise the Tibetan woman's costume jewelry. Those who cannot afford gold wear silver ornaments. Even the poorest woman displays silver earrings set with turquoise or malachite as a makeshift, and perhaps a string of glass beads. Sometimes wealthy women wear priceless hats with rows of pearls around the crown. Where do the Tibetans obtain the stones and metal for the elaborate ornaments which are an essential part of the costumes worn not only by the women, but by the men too? Enough gold is still found in Tibet by crude surface methods to provide settings. As for silver, most of it probably comes from China. Pearls, coral and other jewels come from India, Bhutan and Nepal. There has always been a brisk trade between Nepal and Tibet, the best lapidaries in Asia, the most skillful in cutting precious stones, are in Nepal, whence many of the most valuable unset stones are brought by caravan to Tibet. Here native craftsmen fashion the stones in the traditional settings and designs acceptable to Tibetan taste. Tibetans find turquoise in their own mountains, but some of the best turquoise comes from the Chinese province of Honan, and the Muslim merchants in Lhasa sent to Iran for its turquoise, which is of high quality. With the Tibetans, turquoise has always been the most popular and highly esteemed stone. They invest it with special virtues. In their belief, turquoise is a protection against demons, wards off contagion, and brings good luck and health. Large turquoises are sometimes engraved with a mystic incantation to give them even greater power against evil and illness. In view of the emphasis Tibetans place on charms as a means of preventing illness, you may wonder what is the standing of medicine in Tibet. Any comment I can make is naturally the superficial observation of a layman. Besides, there are no statistics or census taking in Tibet from which one can obtain specific data about medicine, disease or any other vital information. On the summit of Chakpari Peak, Iron Hill, in Lhasa is the medical college, to which students come from all the large monasteries. Some idea of the status of modern medical science in Tibet may be obtained from the curriculum of this institution. The course takes 8 years, and the students spend most of this time memorizing long incantations and spells. They do acquire some knowledge of the medicinal value of certain herbs, but they have no knowledge of anatomy or of the functions and positions of the principal organs of the body. A patient suspected of having a contagious disease may have his pulse felt at the end of a long piece of string. Smallpox has made terrific ravages on the population, but they are slowly beginning to learn about vaccination. Musk, camphor and aconite, used in the preparation of Western medicines, are also familiar to the monk physicians who are graduates of the Lhasa Medical College. Nevertheless, such concoctions as the urine and excreta of Dalai and Panchen Lamas are also regarded as efficacious cures for any complaint. Generally speaking, the Tibetan still relies more on spells, incantations and the exorcism of evil spirits than on even such inadequate medicines as are known to his Lama physicians. Whatever the illness, Lamas are invited to come to the home of the patient and read passages from the sacred books, especially from the Book of Prayers to the God of Medicine. 14. We talk with Lhasa officials. Mukyu of our time in Lhasa was devoted to chats with officials of the Dalai Lama's government. But before I discuss the talks, I should like to explain how this theocratic country operates. First, it must be noted that nothing about the government is hard and fixed. The Lhasa setup often changes from Dalai Lama to Dalai Lama. A description of such a fluctuating system may be accurate for only a few years, but currently Tibet is regulated as follows: because the present God King is not yet 18, the age when he will personally take over the rule, the regent governs for him in all matters of state. Under the regent are three cabinets, each charged with different duties and holding various degrees of influence. The most powerful cabinet is the Kashag, composed of three Shapay-copyright lay ministers and one monk Shapay-copyright, the Kalon Lama, who is the senior minister of the quartet. All functions of government, executive, judicial and legislative are vested in these four men, who are appointed by the regent. The Shapay-copyright, who receive an annual salary of 25 rupees, about $5, are wealthy jand owners and financially independent. Above the two lower cabinets in authority and prestige is the Lord Chamberlain, or Chikyap Kempo, who is the head of all the priest officials in the country. Both in that capacity and as a member of the Dalai Lama's household, he wields enormous influence and power. Of the two minor cabinets, one is composed of monks and the other of laymen. The first, the foreman Yikchang, appoints all monk officials and deals with religious matters. The corresponding foreman lay cabinet, whose members are called sepons, controls Tibetan financial and trade matters. A recent addition to these cabinets is a Foreign Affairs Bureau. There is a National Assembly called the Tsongdu. Not an elected body, it is composed of several hundred of the more important government officials. It convenes on invitation of the Dalai Lama or the regent whenever specially vital issues face the government. The Tsongdu has the power, seldom used, however, to vote out the regent. This body rarely meets in full assembly but performs most of its duties through a large committee which receives legislative bills from the Kashag, makes certain recommendations and returns them to be forwarded to the Dalai Lama or to the regent. For every important government job in Tibet, two men are appointed, one a monk and the other a layman. The monk always has seniority, giving the ecclesiastical group the real control of the country. All Tibetan officials are sensitive to the wishes of the priesthood, especially to the whims of the abbots of the three large monasteries at Lhasa Drepung, Sera and Ganden. Tibet is divided into some 60 districts, with vague territorial divisions. Each district is known as a dzong, the dzongpan being its governor. The bulk of government revenue comes from these dzongs, mostly as a result of trade activity. The dzong pay tilde copyright ns have to submit a fixed amount by way of taxes each year. If a governor manages to squeeze more than the required revenue from his district, he may pocket the surplus. The country has its own currency, with the sang as the basic monetary unit, also, its own postal system. The mails go through on irregular schedules. Postal runners, carrying belt-carated spears as insignia of their office, jog along the mountain trails in 5-mile relays, with letters from Lhasa to Giants. From there the mail is carried by the India-managed Pony Express on the backs of mules. An additional, but unofficial part in the Tibetan government is played by the various oracles or prophets on whose prognostications numerous decisions of state are based. Many such soothsayers thrive in the Dalai Lama's land, but the most influential is the Nakhung oracle near Lhasa, the nation's chief seer. Once a month this forecaster goes into a trance and peers into the future to help guide the decisions of officials and the lives of commoners. Tibetans have great faith in the oracles and are inclined to rely completely on their predictions. We have been asked by many of our friends what we did on a typical day in Lhasa. Let's take the 4th of September, for example. At 7 a.m., looking out at the golden roofs of the Potala flashing in the sun, we crawled from our warm sleeping bags. At that hour it was uncomfortably chilly in our room, for there was no means of heating it, and the summer nights at 12,000 feet are cold. It happened to be the time of full moon, which meant that Lhasa's dogs had kept us awake most of the night. During the day these scavengers curled up in the streets, but at night the amount of howling, barking and fighting was beyond belief. In Lhasa you'd hardly call the dog man's best friend, growled my father as we started dressing. 234. The Vatican of Tibet. The Potala rises 900 feet above the Lhasa plain. This view of it, clearly reflected in reverse in the still water of the foreground, we saw each morning from our quarters at Trader Linga. 235. Our first words to our servant each morning were always the same, Sirda. Ho, Sirda. Good morning, how about some garam pant, hot water? Usually a kettle for washing had arrived by the time we finished lacing our boots. Then it was, Sirda, is breakfast ready? The Sirda's answer was always the same, yes, Sahib, breakfast ready. Just now coming. From Norbu's grimy, smoky kitchen the Sirda brought our stewed prunes, oatmeal with hot milk, toast and fried eggs. After breakfast, Dor arrived to take us on the day's rounds. First stop was the luxurious home of the finance minister, Sepun Sheikh Abba, the official most responsible for our permission to visit Lhasa, whom we had met a few days before at the festival luncheon. A fine-looking man of 45 or so, that Sepun is keenly aware of what is going on in the world today and of the problems facing his country under the present disturbing conditions. Dor translated for us as we consumed a few cups of tea and asked our host questions about trade. He expressed disappointment at the failure to make any headway in America with his trade mission. According to that Sepun, Tibet's economy hinges upon its exports, most of them to the outside world by way of India. Wool is the principal export, followed by musk, furs and yak tails. Trade with the United States averages annually from $2 to $3 million. But, Butsepun explained, all this business has been negotiated through India, which, in the role of middleman, pays Tibetan rupees.